This is November 29th, 2014, and I'm going to, of course, talk about the 16 precepts and the ceremony in which we have the opportunity to receive these 16 precepts formally. As we said in a recent mailing a few days ago, normally I try in the lead up, we have this twice a year, the precept ceremony. Jukai is the Japanese word for it. One in the spring and one in the fall. And usually I find a Sunday or two or even three beforehand to start wading into this major aspect of Zen practice. It just didn't work out this time. Too many other things, including our ceremony of gratitude last Sunday rather than on Thanksgiving Day. So I'm kind of backed into a corner here where I have a lot to say about these precepts, but very little time to say much about them. So then what I did was invite people to hear previous teishos on the precepts by podcast. So today I'm going to try to squeeze in mainly talk about the fourth of the 10 cardinal precepts, not to lie but to speak the truth. But in doing so, and even before doing so, I do feel I'm obliged to say something more generally about the ceremony that's coming up later this afternoon. A major point of Zen teaching is that what are called the three essentials of practice. And these are meditation, morality, and wisdom. I won't say much about meditation today. The morality is what really the precepts, that's the category that the precepts fall under, of course. These are moral precepts that we'll be taking. But it's, I think, important to understand that this is not fundamentally, it's not so much about morality as such as it is about actualizing who we really are. Because in our true nature, we don't want to kill or steal or misuse sexuality or lie or abuse alcohol or drugs and so forth. That's our nature. That the 10 cardinal precepts, there's 16 altogether. So the first three are the three refuges or the three treasures. I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. We do those all the time here in the Zendo, right before chanting services. Those are the first three. The next three are a resolve not to, resolve to avoid evil, a resolve to do good, a resolve to liberate all living beings. That's when we get more into the obvious moral aspect of this. And then the last 10 are the 10 cardinal precepts. And these really are just ways of being true to who we are. So, yeah, we can say morality. Another translation for this morality thing is discipline. Disciplining ourselves. And then the third is prajna, which means wisdom, our innate wisdom. And these three are like it's like a tripod of, that supports practice and self-purification and development, are these three: meditation, morality, and wisdom. I like to think of morality. The original word is Shila, S-I-L-A, pronounced Shila. is really just a way to move through the world without causing unnecessary pain. We do cause pain, inevitably, all of us, certainly in very strictly speaking, necessary ways, taking the life of, if not animals and fish, at least taking the lives of vegetables and other things like that. But in other ways too, it's inevitable. This is the human predicament, that we will, just in interacting with people, even in the purest kind of motives, we're going to cause pain. But we don't have to cause unnecessary pain. I mean, we can reduce that as much as possible, and that's what the precepts really are all about. Rather than thinking of it as a moral issue, think of it as just not causing unnecessary pain to not just to others, but to ourselves. It's the same, ultimately. If we can live up to these precepts, is a way of developing faith. And that is what is at the very ground of viable practice, faith in our own true nature. These precepts, you could say, sort of describe, they're descriptive of who we really are. And to the degree that we can live in accord with these precepts, we will have greater faith in our Buddha nature. Always remember, the word Buddha means the awakened one, and that ultimately means ourselves. So when we take refuge in Buddha, we're really taking refuge in placing our faith in our own Buddha nature. It's not just looking to this man in India 2,500 years ago, but we're placing our faith in our Buddha nature. That is our innate, not goodness, that limits it to say we're fundamentally good. And then you set up a duality. But really, I think a better way to think of it is our ability to change. Placing our faith in our true nature, our essential nature, these are all synonyms, our way of grounding our practice in the faith that we can change. We're not stuck with our nasty habits and ways of reacting to people that cause pain. So it's to the degree that we can uphold these precepts, we're preventing the self-doubt that inevitably creeps into practice when it's very serious practice, or not, even when it's just casual practice. It's casual partly because of self-doubt, because we don't really believe in ourselves. So it's not a matter of pitting our good self against our bad self. This has nothing to do with this. There aren't two selves, there aren't two natures that we have, a true nature and a false nature. But it's really when we simply see ourselves wholly, then we will want to refrain from killing, stealing, misusing sexuality, and so forth. To see ourselves wholly, that is to really recognize ourselves, we need to still the mind. And then in that stillness, we're in accord with our true nature. Zen and Buddhism more broadly recognizes that this matter of the precepts is one that none of us can hope to live up to in the purest sense all the time. every one of us, without exception, is slipping off one or more of these precepts all the time. And it's just a matter of catching ourselves and then just picking ourselves up again and moving on, just making the resolve to do better. And then we're going to slip again, and then we pick ourselves up and we make the resolve to do better, and so forth. So it's an ongoing process. Before I say more about the precepts, the fourth precept in particular, just a word about the ceremony this afternoon at 5 o'clock. We begin with a repentance verse. All evil actions committed by me since time immemorial, stemming from greed, anger, and delusion, arising from body, speech, and mind, I now repent having committed. And this is a way of it's a resetting ritual. We're basically saying, okay, we're starting afresh here. Whatever our conduct has been in the past, no matter how many times we have slipped into the same old reactive patterns and same old anger and hostility and greed and confusion, now we start afresh. It's very important, this resetting aspect of the ceremony. And then we go on to the first three of the 16 precepts mentioned. First, I take refuge in Buddha. Take refuge is the traditional, the most widely used translation of the original language in the Pali and the Sanskrit, but it really means I place myself, my full faith in Buddha, my own Buddha nature, my own inherent purity, my ability to change, which really means my lack of any fixed self that I'm stuck with. I take refuge in my own fundamentally enlightened nature. The second, I take refuge in Dharma. This is variously understood as the way, the Tao, the way things are, the law, and more narrowly can be understood as this teaching that we are all fundamentally enlightened and we can realize that enlightenment. And then change. I place my faith in my ability to change because there is no self we're stuck with. And then the third is I take refuge in Sangha, which means anyone who is committed to their own Buddha nature, living up to their own Buddha nature and this teaching. So everyone here now sitting in the Zendo, and certainly it means anyone who's practicing this, but not only Zen, more broadly we can understand it as anyone who is sincerely working to purify herself or himself, whatever religion, whatever path you might be doing. This is really a remarkable distinction. People who recognize their own selfishness and want to do something about it. That's something really wonderful, and the particular path you take is less important. after the three refuges, sometimes they're called the three treasures, taking refuge in the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then the next three are very short, resolve to avoid evil, a resolve to do good, and a resolve to liberate all living beings. It's just a kind of more general way of expressing our aspiration to get straight with ourselves, to be who we really are. And then the next ten, the final ten, are the ten cardinal precepts. And these are really an elaboration or a greater articulation of the previous three general resolutions, to avoid evil, to do good, and liberate all living beings. And the precepts, the ten cardinal precepts, are formulated. They begin with the negative, a resolve not to kill. And then they go on to the positive. That's the avoid evil part. And then the do good is but to cherish all life. And then the third, to liberate all living beings. That's what happens when we avoid evil and do good. This is a way of liberating all beings. So now on to the precept of not lying. This is the fourth of the ten cardinal precepts. Just a kind of a side note. What they say that is true in all Buddhist countries, China, Japan, Tibet, Korea, Vietnam, Sri Lanka, Burma, other countries. Is the these first five precepts, and then in the Mahayana, many streams of Mahayana have added the last five, the second five. So the altogether these ten cardinal precepts I've read here are from a sutra called the Sutra of Brahma's Net. These ten cardinal precepts, it says, along with the 48 secondary precepts, we won't be doing those this afternoon. First I'd have to know what they were. Are called the Mahayana perfect immediate precepts, because they offer a direct possibility of immediately becoming a Buddha to the one who is able to realize them completely. And taking these 16 precepts, just to go back a little bit, taking these 16 precepts formally in a ceremony is really means it's a way of formally becoming a Buddhist, a practitioner, a member of the Buddhist family, we sometimes say. Now, you can take the precepts without complete resolve about being... You don't have... The trouble with the word Buddhist is it becomes a kind of self-identity, which is something we're trying to avoid in Zen practice. So if you have the wish, if you want, if you feel ready to consider yourself member of the Buddhist family, then this is the formalizing of that. But even people who are not so sure about their commitment to the Dharma can certainly take this ceremony and can only benefit from it. In other Zen centers and temples, sometimes they make a much bigger thing about this ceremony than we do. in that there's months of preparation and education, classes and all, and it's really the equivalent of ordination. But our way in our lineage has always been that it's open to anyone, and it doesn't, certainly is not anything like ordination, which in our school, in our lineage, means a vocational commitment for life to do this as one's path, one's vocation. Resolve not to lie, but to speak the truth. You could sum this up as being, it means to be true. And first and foremost, this means true to our nature. Lying is specifically speech. It is the key element, component in the what is often called right speech. This takes us to the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the last of the Four Noble Truths. This is the sort of the recipe or the prescription for living a life of truth, is living up to these eight things, the third of which is right speech, or true speech might be a better modifier, true speech. They're basically to lie really means the intention to mislead. The intention. There has to be the intention to mislead. If you're making a statement that's false, it isn't necessarily a lie. This could be ignorance. And there are two kinds of intention to mislead. There is to do so through concealment, and to do so by falsifying what we're saying. These are often called the lies of omission and lies of commission. We know the term a white lie. A white lie, you could say just very briefly, simply, is lying for another person's benefit. And there are times when this is called for. I'm going to be reading from a book called The Honest Truth About Dishonesty by Dan Ariely. And in this book, he talks about he was a burn victim. He went through, when he was a teenager, something exploded next to him, and he had a whole lot of surgeries and medical procedures. And he talks about how before one excruciatingly painful surgery, doctors were not forthcoming. They were not. They somewhat concealed how bad it would be. But he now, after having suffered through that, he feels what they did was good, because it kept him positive and optimistic going into the surgery. And, there's research that shows that a lot of what we experience as pain comes from the fear of it. We're sort of bracing ourselves to have the pain, and that exacerbates it. And he feels that was an example of a white lie that was justified, and he appreciates that they weren't fully honest with him in the typical way. The danger with this concept of white lies is that we can convince ourselves that we're doing it for others' benefit when we really aren't. A lot of lying is just wanting to protect ourselves from the judgments of others, their disapproval, their anger. So a lot of lying just comes out of fear. We're afraid of how others will react. But what that really means, though, underneath that, is we're afraid of our own self-judgments. We're afraid of seeing ourselves completely. And that's where the practice comes in, where the meditation comes in. Because in doing daily meditation, and especially if that is augmented by occasional sesshin attendance, these intensive retreats, meditation retreats, by doing that, we come to see ourselves more and more wholly, more fully. We can't run and we can't hide from how our minds work, how our emotions and our feelings work, and we come more and more to see ourselves as we are. And a natural byproduct of that is that we're able to relax and be more forthcoming with others about who we really are. We fear what we create this shadow or there's no need to be afraid of who we are. That it's everything is has to arise from self-understanding. And that's what meditation brings. I think this is why more people don't do it, is they're afraid of what they're going to uncover. And yes, it can be unpleasant, it can be humbling, it can be humiliating to see our how much selfishness we have, how much pettiness and the judgments we are have always been making toward other people without even knowing it. This is one of the most common reports of people when they first get serious in their meditation, is how much their judgmental mind just won't quit. And that is painful. It's painful to see the ways that we have tried to hide from ourselves. I think a lot of this precept, not to lie but to speak the truth, really would fall under the broader injunction of developing integrity. Lying is one betrayal of our integrity. Cheating is another betrayal. I'm going to get into do a teisho on cheating. I see that lying is more on a verbal level, and cheating more is a behavioral way of betraying ourselves. But I'll do something on cheating this winter during tax season. But both, I think, go right to the essence of integrity. Integrity, I looked this up, got a dictionary definition. Integrity is the quality or state of being complete, unbroken condition, wholeness, entirety. It's a rich, rich word, integrity. The third definition is the quality or state of being of sound moral principle, uprightness, honesty, sincerity. In serious meditation, we are becoming integrated. We are integrating aspects or components of ourselves, features of ourselves that we have pushed away or covered over. And just seeing these things is the key thing. Just seeing them, becoming aware of them. And we will become aware of them. We don't have to try to become aware of them. That's not our agenda, to become aware of things that we have pushed away and covered up. They will out. Things will eventually will all be exposed. And that is the healthiest thing we can possibly do, is to face ourselves and all of our features. This is ultimately seeing our original face. I've spoken in the past, but I'll do it again, about a calligraphy of Zen Master Hakuin. He was not only an illustrious Zen master, but a painter and calligrapher. And at an exhibition in Ithaca about 20 years or 25 years ago, we drove down and we saw this exhibition of Hakuin's paintings and calligraphies, and the one that stuck with me the most was a calligraphy for the word virtue. That's the translation. We could say virtue, or we could say good. But it consists of two characters. One is honesty, and the other is heart. And it's a bold, strong, thick, broad stroke thing, black and just booming with strength in this honesty and heart, not lying, speaking the truth. Heart is one way. When we say heart, when we in the West say heart, we think of more of this emotional center. Another way to translate that character that was in the caption, it was translated as heart, is our true nature, our true mind. Honesty, heart, true mind, integrity. Being the same person to your parents, to your children, to your partner, to your boss, to your employees, within reason. There's obviously there's a place for boundaries, but this is something that we grow into. Again, we don't have to make a project out of this. It all happens, not overnight, but it happens by and by, through long practice, we grow into a whole person. to lie is to incur stress. It's hard to maintain lies. It's hard to be divided. It takes a toll on us. So upholding this precept of not lying but speaking the truth is, again, is not such a much a moral issue as a quality of life issue. It's a matter of our own happiness, just for starters, having a joyful life rather than cowering, hiding behind our lies. Once heard about a guy, a manual laborer, who said in a real folksy, simple way, he says, I like telling the truth because I like traveling light. Zen Master Dogen urged his monks to conduct themselves in private no differently from when they were before other people. It's a tall order, but something we can grow into little by little. Houston Smith, wonderful writer on religion, said, deceit is bad because it reduces one's being. There's an article I uncovered in from the New York Times. It's a column. This is from last year, actually. It's called Great Betrayals. It's an opinion piece, and it's by Anna Fels, F-E-L-S, a psychiatrist and faculty member at Weill Cornell Medical School. Cornell, maybe. She also saw that calligraphy by Hakuin. And she says, she talks about great betrayals, how shaken she was recently to have heard from an old friend that her husband of nearly 25 years had long been accruing and hiding from her a huge credit card debt in the six figures. Even after divulging his secret, the husband had lied about the amount, with the sum increasing every time it was discussed. And right from the start, he refused to document where the money was spent. He left it for his wife to ruminate on, trying to puzzle it out. The disclosure wreaked financial and emotional havoc on their family, of course. And then she goes on in this piece to say that the liar or the cheater or the betrayer has the easier time after the truth comes out. Those of us who have finally screwed up the courage to disclose a lie know the kind of relief and even some peace of mind that can come from that, which is where repentance comes in. In our ceremony this afternoon, there's none of us is offering any specific repentance for any specific deed. But these are things that repentance is something one can do on one's own. It can be enormously liberating, especially if you voice it, not just think it. That doesn't have much power at all. But if you speak it, then it can really be liberating. But what her point was that and she says that, here I'll read it, and to an astonishing extent the social blowback for such miscreants is often transient and relatively minor. They can change. Our culture, in fact, wholeheartedly supports such, quote, new beginnings, even celebrates them. It is a soft spot for the prodigal sons and daughters who set about repairing their ways, for tales of people starting over, reformed addicts, unfaithful spouses who rededicate themselves to family, convicted felons who find redemption in religion. Talk shows thrive on these tales. Perhaps it's part of our powerful national belief in self-help and self-creation. It's never too late to start anew. But, she says, but for the people who have been lied to, something more pervasive and disturbing occurs. They castigate themselves about why they didn't suspect what was going on. The emotions they feel, while seemingly more benign than those of the perpetrator, may in the long run be more corrosive. Humiliation, embarrassment, a sense of having been naive or blind, alienation from those who knew the truth all along, and, worst of all, bitterness. By the way, the alienation from those who knew the truth all along, this is a real tough nut to crack. I've heard or maybe seen in a movie or something some ethical dilemma where you suspect that your, let's say in the case of a woman, you suspect that your woman friend is being cheated on by her husband, and do you share your suspicion with her? And but then the author here, Anna Fels, goes on, insidiously the new information disrupts their sense of their own past, undermining the veracity of their personal history. Like a computer file corrupted by a virus, their life narrative has been invaded. Memories are now suspect. What was really going on that day? Why did the spouse suddenly buy a second phone, quote, for work, several years ago? Did a friend know the truth even as they vacationed together? Compulsively going over past events in light of their recently acquired knowledge, such patients struggle to integrate the new version of reality. For many people, this discrediting of their experience is hard to accept. It's as if they are constantly reviewing their past lives on a dual screen, the life they experienced on one side and the new, true version on the other. But putting a story together about this kind of disjunctive past can be arduous. Recently, earlier this year, we at the Zen Center had a little taste of this when we discovered that someone who had been here in residential training for a few weeks had been using drugs, and this was quite humbling to realize. I'll just speak for myself that's something I had missed. But I think what the kind of disruption to one's understanding of oneself is no big deal. It doesn't really have much of an effect if you're not clinging to a self concept. If you're not clinging to thoughts, basically. Okay, so you find that you missed something, that you were taken for a ride by someone. Of course, what I'm talking about with this guy here is nothing compared to the scale of what she's talking about. But still, the pain and the disruption that she describes that can happen would be much reduced if you're not dwelling on it. And that's again where practice comes in. Do you want to do that to yourself, sitting and ruminating and thinking about what you missed and this and that? And this is where this is a place for just moving forward, and you can even kind of laugh at how you were blindsided. and learn from it, of course, as we did. It really, this precept, not to lie but to speak the truth, at its base, it comes down to self-deception. This book I mentioned in my hands here, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, he gets into a little bit into neuroscience. Our left brain is the interpreter, the half that spins a narrative from our experiences. And he says this is a tendency we all have. We want explanations for why we behave as we do and for the ways the world around us functions, even when our feeble explanations have little to do with reality. We're storytelling creatures by nature, and we tell ourselves story after story until we come up with an explanation that we like and that sounds reasonable enough to believe. And when the story portrays us in a more glowing and positive light, so much the better. A monk, there's a story from Tang Dynasty China where a monk asked Joshu, what is the first principle of the one wearing Buddhist robes? And Joshu said, not to deceive himself. And I think it's important to understand that very often when people are, quote, lying, that it may not be that. Remember, lying is the intention to mislead. And in many cases, we believe our lies. We don't think there is no intention to mislead. We believe. The people who deny climate change, there, I've said it. Those who deny climate change may not be lying at all. They may completely believe it. The mine owners who neglect all the safety regulations and say that they're safe may be believing it. Here too, through long meditation, we come to see the many ways we deceive ourselves, and we become less judgmental about others and more understanding. It doesn't mean that the mine owners should be given a free ride and not have to do it, but to not, if it takes some of the judgment out of it, again, yeah, seeing our own tendencies, strong, persistent tendencies to deceive ourselves. And this is known even in the wider culture. Richard Feynman, the physicist, he told in a commencement speech, he told graduates, the first principle is that you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool. He gets a little more into neuroscience, talks about the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that sits just behind our foreheads and is considered to be in charge of higher order thinking, such as planning, deciding, and moral judgments. It's a kind of control tower for thinking, reasoning, and morality. And he talks about pathological liars in terms of gray matter and white matter. Gray matter is just another name for the collections of neurons that make up the bulk of our brains, the stuff that powers our thinking. White matter is the wiring that connects those brain cells. We all have both gray and white matter, but Yang and her collaborators were particularly, this is a research they did, were particularly interested in the relative amounts of the two types in the participants' prefrontal cortices. They found that pathological liars had 14% less gray matter than the control groups. And then he speculates that this means that since the pathological liars had fewer brain cells, the gray matter, fueling their prefrontal cortex, they find it harder to take morality into account, making it easier for them to lie. Pathological liars had 22 to 26% more white matter in the prefrontal cortex than non-pathological liars. With more white matter, remember, this is what links the gray matter, pathological liars are likely able to make more connections between different memories and ideas, and this increased connectivity and access to the world of associations stored in their gray matter might be the secret ingredient that makes them natural liars. It says that they have more avenues to explore when it comes to interpreting and explaining dubious events. So there's the neuroscientific correlate to these things. And then they found in this research that creativity correlated with greater ease in lying. Not intelligence. You weren't more likely to lie if you had a higher IQ, but you were if you had greater creativity. And because this, he said, relates to moral flexibility, quote unquote, which is... as it turned out, the level of moral flexibility was highly related to the level of creativity required in their department and by their job. Designers and copywriters were at the top of the moral flexibility scale, and the accountants ranked at the bottom. It seems, he says, it seems that when creativity is in our job description, we are more likely to say, go for it, when it comes to dishonest behavior. Well, that's all the time we have. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.